So we were in chapter 32 and chapter 33 in Genesis, and I'll go ahead and turn there. We'll read them, and then we'll do like normal. Just give me your input, what you thought, what you got of the chapters, and see where it takes us. So in chapter 32, starting in verse 1, so Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, "Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants, and I've sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. And he said, "If Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the other company which is left will escape." Then Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your kindred, and I will dwell with you,' I'm not worthy of the least of your mercies and all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother of the children with and the mother with the children. For you said, 'I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sands of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude.'" So he lodged there that same night and took what came into his hand as a present for Esau, his brother: 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. Then he delivered them to the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass on over before me and put some distance between successive droves." And he commanded the first one, saying, "When Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong and where are you going? Whose are these in front of you?' Then you shall say to him, 'They are your servant Jacob's. And it is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us.'" So he commanded the second and the third, and all who followed the droves, saying, "In this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And also say, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, 'I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me.' So the present went on over before him, but he himself lodged that night in the camp. And he arose that night and took his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jacob. Jabbok, and took them, sent them over the brook, and sent them over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Now, when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." For he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, why is it that you ask about my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of that place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. Just as he crossed over Penuel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is in the hip of the socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. So, let's just do chapter 32 right now and see what you guys got out of the time that you read it.
First, he recognized the angels.
Yeah. He'd seen those before, hadn't he?
Yes.
He recognized angels.
Yes. The second... It was interesting. So Jacob was greatly afraid and grew sullen and distressed. It's interesting how his life up to this point is changing.
Mm-hmm. It's
changing him on the inside. And then he says, in 9, I like this. Then Jacob said, oh God of my father Abraham and God of my father. He didn't call him the fear of Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
Calls him the God.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord who said to me, now he's saying, God, you said this to me. And now it's like he's grabbing hold of his God.
Of his what?
Of his God. He's making him his God.
Mm-hmm.
More and more.
Yeah, know? I think it's a progressive work.
Yes. you see it in the next verse. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies.
You're going to have to speak up on this. It's not going to
be. Oh, I'm sorry. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies of tender loving kindness. He mm-hmm. sees it. He sees, he's getting intimate. I see this intimate
mm-hmm.
relationship growing right now. You know, mm-hmm. I know he's like, I'm scared to death.
mm-hmm.
You know, and I have nowhere to go but you, God.
Yeah.
You're the one that said all of this, and here I am. You told me to go home. Here I am.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. And you know, I crossed over Jordan with a staff, and now I've become two companies.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, in 12, I'm sorry, I'm preaching here, I think.
You're not preaching. You're reading, but good. That's okay.
Okay.
Particularly, what is it you got?
Okay, well, I'm just saying a progressive, you know, struggle. The yeah. human struggle with mm-hmm. God.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I see that as well.
Yeah.
It's a progressive work that God is doing. I think that at this point, Jacob still really did not have what I would call a real relationship with God. I think that what he had was, and I mean that by our standards and even the standards that Abraham had by the time he took Isaac up to offer him. I don't think he had anything close to that relationship with God. I think that he had come to trust that God, I know without question, he had come to trust that God would take care of him. Because the provision thing didn't seem to be a problem for Jacob. But he was still scared over his safety. He never, even up to this point, still was not trusting God to take care of him. He was afraid. And that becomes clear even later on. He's still clear. He's still afraid after God speaks to him. He continues to walk in fear.
He was concerned for the children.
Yes, I'm sure he was concerned for everybody, but we know who he's concerned for the most because at the very end, he's even sent his wife and his children over before he would be willing to go over. So he's concerned about his own neck. So, you know, this is a progressive, but it, like you said, I agree. It's a progressive work, and I think God is gaining more and more of his heart. And I think that, you know, at times when we are facing very difficult times that can gender fear on the inside of us, we have a tendency to become more reflective and recognize, be willing to admit more about what God has been doing. than maybe we might have even really paid attention to before. I don't know that he would have denied it. I just don't know that he really would have given a whole lot of thought to it until this moment. He may have. We don't have a record of it one way or the other, but we do have a record of it here, that he was definitely taking stock. So,
and I think God had blessed him to the point that he had all of this stuff that he could try to appease his brother with.
Yeah.
Because he knew that his brother hated him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought, well, if I send him this, all this stuff, which when he headed out from Laban, he didn't have that stuff. You know, I mean, he split the goats and and took all the imperfect stuff. So he had built all this up, you know, so God, yes, God blessed.
Oh, yeah.
In a huge and mighty way.
Yep.
So he can see, you know, God said he was going to bless. And by golly, he's doing it.
Yeah.
And I got these 12 boys and who knows how many girls.
Yeah.
You know, so, and he said what he said about, you know, becoming as
two companies. Yeah.
Two companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, when he, I think in his, I can't think for somebody else, but I would be thinking, let's get them safely tucked away. You've got one that's going to hit Esau and hopefully do well. And then right behind him, you got the more coming. So he's there's time progressing in between.
Oh, yeah.
It's not like he sent him out and he wrestled that night. You know, this is time lapse. And a lot of time has gone by. But he made sure that he took care of his family.
Yeah, they're the last ones to send over.
So he did everything that he could in his own power to make sure everybody was well cared for. And then I'm just gonna sit right here and see what happens. And that's when he wrestled with the angel.
Yeah.
And at that point he said, I'm not quitting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in this for the long haul.
Yeah.
You can go ahead and dislocate my hip. It may be dislocated, but, you know, I'm still hanging in there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no doubt that Jacob was definitely tenacious. Very much so.
So I think that, you know, and then when God spoke and changed his name, he changed Abram's name. You know, he didn't change his father's name, but he did change his grandfather's name. So he had to have known that this is a big deal.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, for God to change my name to something else, this is pretty big.
Oh, yeah. So he knew this was his meeting with God. Absolutely. I agree. Yeah, go ahead.
I see him as reflecting back on the past and allowing the past to dictate the present. His present actions, although they've been, two decades at least that he'd been gone?
And 20 years.
Esau really wanted to do anything. He probably could have found a way to do something during that time, but yet he's still thinking Esau is exactly the same as he had been, never having had contact with him.
Yeah, not knowing.
That would be understandable as to why he might do that, but then again, if he's really trusting in God, he'd think, well, you know, maybe God's touched his heart. I will send an emissary to talk to Esau rather than do all this other stuff first. And see if perhaps there has been a change of heart, because to me, in my eyes, it looks as though he's coming to kill
him.
And yet, in my heart, I'd like to think that that's not the case. He's not living that out as to where he thinks that might be the case.
It's clear because he said he was afraid.
But we don't give people an opportunity to change. I mean, we look at things like, well, this is the way they were, so they got to still be that way.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. Yeah.
When he was saying, "Oh God, I'm not worthy of all that you've done," it was such a different statement than the one at Bethel.
Oh, yeah.
He says, oh, God, you know, if you do this for me, yeah, you'll be my God, or, mm-hmm. you know, and all yeah. that. And now it's like...
This was marked more by humility.
And I think one of the things that came to me was being with Laban and seeing how deceptive he was.
Mm-hmm.
Made him see his deception even more in a bigger light.
It's possible.
And it worked on him. You know, I'm getting what I, you know, what I sowed before
mm-hmm.
is coming back at me now. And all these years he's mm-hmm. been cheated.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just a one time or two times thing.
Uh-huh.
With 20 years almost. And it's like Bruce said, he's reflecting. To him, he's okay. Is my brother thinking I'm the same person that I was?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like we see ourselves as the same person. I was that person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you still harbor.
Mm-hmm.
things, and
it's there's no question he was wondering whether Esau harbored things. So the last word he heard was that he wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, you know, you don't easily forget that. You know, your next of kin wants to kill you.
Yeah.
You that seems to stick with you.
And coming with 400 men, that's a little intimidating.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only word that he had back was, yeah, because I mean, if Esau, I'm sure that Jacob's mind was probably thinking that if Esau intended me good, he would have sent word back saying something along that line that I'm looking forward to see my brother, blah, 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 bid him, you know, well, whatever. The only thing I hear is that he's coming and he's bringing 400 people with him. That doesn't strike somebody as painting a good picture. Yeah, it sounds very much like his suspicions are probably true, you know. So, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would you elaborate a little bit more on the wrestling with the angel?
Yeah, we will address
sure.
that.
Huh?
I'll address that. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Because I'm not sure why that was put in there.
I'll help a little bit on that.
Okay.
To some degree. I mean, what I can offer, of course, is just understanding and some speculation, because it doesn't, the scripture isn't telling you specifically why, but when you read it in context, it looks, I think I'm pretty sure why it happened the way it did. So, yeah.
Just simple thoughts of that first one about, you know, the angels of God met with him. It's interesting. It doesn't really say a lot. It's very, very mild.
Mm-hmm.
Also, again, it's a new chapter. It's leaving one thing, and it's
mm-hmm.
like God meets him again. And
exactly.
It seems to happen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then also where he begins calling out to God, it's like we all do in one vein or another. Trouble comes and we're like, oh God,
yeah,
you said this and you said that, and are you going to help me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's almost in the form of a question more than
a
statement.
Kind of feel like that's kind of partial what's there.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's safe because he's a human being.
Yeah.
And it's what we do, you know? So, I agree.
Well, I mean, even in Jacob's... Oh, I'm sorry, did I step on somebody?
No. I just noticed her coming in. Hey, Vivian.
Oh, in Jacob's mind,
mm-hmm.
he believes...
Oh, yeah.
At this point in verse 30...
Mm-hmm.
He met God face to face.
Oh, yeah. That's who he believes he was wrestling with. There's no question. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So irregardless of, you know, that's what it's, what do you care what my name is?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that was a turning point.
I think it was, too. That was, I don't think there's any question. I agree with you.
Well, I also saw there in verse 10, like Virginia was pointing out, in that area there where he's talking about God, he's definitely coming reservedly. In verse 10, is the word I used was humble. He's coming in a sense humbly because, you know, I'm not worthy. He's recognizing, you know, so in that sense it's good because he's recognizing that this really is the Almighty, powerful God, that is the end of his forefathers.
Mm-hmm.
you know, these are the promises that you said of me. But, you know, I still pick up on that hint of God, I'm in trouble, help me.
Oh, yeah, no question. I mean, he's in that part, which is before he wrestles, I think it's very clear. He's saying, you know, I acknowledge that you've done all these things for me, and I haven't deserved any of them. But let me remind you that you also said you'd keep me safe. Please don't forget that part. That's what I kind of hear in his voice. It's a little bit of a, so you've done everything so far, and that's worked out real well. Thank you for that. And I haven't deserved it. I admit that. I probably don't deserve this next part either, but, you know, you said you'd keep me safe, right? You know, there's a little bit of trepidation there. There's no question, because even before the prayer, it says that he was afraid. Mm-hmm. So even, but even in his fear, he knew where to go. Mm-hmm. So that's a good thing. I mean, we're not trying to take away from what he did have, but there's no question there was still fear there. Yes, huh?
Timeline-wise, when he's saying he's not worthy, he's looking back on what he'd done, not the type of man he was.
I don't really know that it had anything to do with what he had done as much as just that God didn't owe him anything. God is the one that initialized the conversation with Jacob at Bethel. He didn't start it, God did. And God's the one that instituted his promise to Jacob. And Jacob knows that when he approached God at that moment, he was like, you know what? I recognize your God. I know you must be the same guy that my grandfather and my dad called God. And I acknowledge you. And this is an awesome place. And if you'll do everything you said, then I'll make you my God too. So at that point, at the very beginning, there was real question as to whether or not he was going to commit to this relationship. By the time 20 years had passed in reflection, I think that he had been humbled a little bit. And I think that he was looking back and recognizing, you know what, this God didn't owe me anything. He just did this for me. And he probably, being human, he probably did consider and mix in with that his own behavior as to whether or not it warranted any of these blessings. But I think it was more paying attention to the fact that you've given me all this stuff and I never even asked it of you. You know, you just offered it and I didn't deserve it. You know, I never did anything to build up God credits and you owe me. You just showed up and said you're going to do it. And look, 20 years later, you did it. I didn't deserve this. You know, so I think this has a lot more to do with him looking at God's character than reflecting on his own. But I could be wrong.
Well, as you were talking, I just thought that maybe he didn't even think, as we talked at the time, that he did anything.
Yeah.
Because
there was no law.
Didn't know any better.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that he had any reason to think that most of the things he'd done was necessarily wrong. So I never one time saw, that I can recall, Abraham or Isaac or Jacob ever feeling bad or repenting for deception. I don't even think that they batted an eye about it. To them, that was just a way of life. Whereas a Christian would recognize that's wrong. I don't know that they had eyes to see that at all. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, if I'm at Laban's, you know, you one up them before they one up you. That's the way of things. And I don't know that he thought anything of it, you know. Now, later on during his time with Laban, we do know that he'd come to at least trust that this God was going to be his provider, because he gave himself a very limited scope for success in the way that he was dealing with the sheep for the last, and the goats for the last few years that he was with them. Six years that he was with them. Trusting that God was going to prosper him, which God did. So obviously throughout the time he'd gotten to the point at least where he recognized the hand of God is on me. I don't know how it got there, but I know it must be there. And it was strong enough that even Laban recognized it, right? You know, and this is the way it was with all of, you know, so far, all three patriarchs, anybody that was around them, even if they didn't get it, the surrounding areas got, God's with you. They all knew that. You know, I see that as long as you're here, God has dealt, you know, we've had prosperity and stuff like that. So we want to do you good, not evil. You just do the same in return. Remember, we've never been bad to you. Don't be bad to us. And you just stay on our land for free because we know as long as you're here, we're blessed. So have a nice day. Thank you. Right. You know, I mean, this is the way they were treated. So even if they didn't realize, even if they hadn't clued in to the fact that God blessed them, by the time that pagan people were at least saying it, they probably took stock and thought, well, you know, I guess things have turned out pretty good, haven't they? You know, so they definitely gotten to the point, Jacob got to the point where he recognized that God's favor was on him for provision. But again, that seems to be a Jewish thing. Jews, at least Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and most of the Jews that we know today don't have a real problem believing God's going to provide for them. Protect them is another issue, but provide for them, they understand that. And seems to be an ongoing thing. So,
I mean, in a very simplistic way, it's almost the way we come to find Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, first, you know, you hear a little bit about him, you know, and then as, you know, as Jacob walks, you know, you hear a little, and then you're to the point where, oh, well, gosh, he did that, you know. And it builds upon each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, when people accept Christ, I think it's very unusual for them to go from 0 to 100 in...
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I would agree.
In 60 seconds.
Mm-hmm. It's a progressive work.
It's a time progression.
Uh-huh, yeah. I totally agree.
Just like it was with Jacob,
mm-hmm.
You know. Okay, and you hear it today, you know. God says he's gonna, you know, he's gonna protect me. He's gonna, you know, he's gonna show up. Well, let me see if God really is gonna provide for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then he does.
Yeah.
And then people are like, wow.
Yeah.
There really is.
Maybe there's something to this.
There is something to this.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, I remember with Steve. You know, when he first got saved and he cut his hand so badly.
Mm-hmm.
This whole part right here, you could see all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too late to be stitched.
Mm-hmm.
And he was given a little tract
mm-hmm.
on healing. He didn't believe that more than the man in the name.
Mm-hmm.
But he sat and he read it.
Mm-hmm.
He read it 3 times. And although they told him that it would take over a month to heal if he continued to use his hand, mm-hmm. which he did,
mm-hmm.
it was healed in less than a week.
Mm-hmm.
He has no scar to this day. There was no scar there, and it was never stitched, and it was never infected.
Yeah.
And his words were, this crap works,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And he was amazed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know. But, I mean, that's kind of like...
No, I agree with you, absolutely.
Like, you know, you can see it unfold, and I didn't really realize that it unfolded back in Genesis
mm-hmm.
the same way it unfolds
today.
Now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He works with us that way. And then we see it in everything that he does. God is never about quick. He doesn't do much of anything quick. The only thing God did quick was creation.
Yeah.
You know? That was quick, but the rest of it hasn't been. You know, plants grow slow. You know,
he's got all the time there is.
Yeah, that's right.
He's
yeah, he made human babies grow slowly in the womb and slowly once they get out, and he's not in a hurry for any of this. But, you know, I think that's, you know, again, one of the things that facilitates God's work and what he's doing in revealing himself is... It's not a flash download and you get him intellectually and therefore you trust him. You have to experience him over time and therefore gradually develop trust. And God's the one that designed it that way. He could have made it so relationship happens very quickly. So time is obviously plays a factor in what God wants. And he's rarely, if ever, in a hurry. So yeah, I totally agree.
He already knew he's going to take time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
he was not sweating about anything.
No, God doesn't. God's not worried about anything. Yeah,
you're talking about the word relationship, which we discussed a lot in the process of the wrestling match. Jacob wanted; he wasn't going to turn loose. He wanted to become the winner. He He wanted to come out on top, I think. When all he really should have done was just after a little bit say, you know, I surrender, I give up. Okay, God, I've given up all these things, now I want to give up me to you, and let that be it. And in defeat, there would be victory. It wasn't in his eyes, he'd probably look at his defeat, but he'd be even much more victorious.
Yeah, that's the truth with all of us. Okay, let's go ahead and start in the very beginning. I'm going to start actually in verse 2. We'll just work through it.
Are you going to talk a little bit more about the wrestle?
Yes, we will.
Okay.
Yeah, we're going to start. I'm going through chapter the one we just went through, but I'm going to give you my comments now.
Okay.
32, you mean?
Yeah, 32. The name, that name of the camp means two camps. When it says in verse 2, when Jacob saw them, he said, this is God's camp, and he called the name of the place two camps. So it's my camp and God's camp. Okay, so two camps. Verse 3, the messengers that he sent, I think it's interesting because, again, he had just got done. It says he had just got done seeing angels, and then he sent messengers. And so it's at least to me on the table that the people that he sent ahead of him may have been angels. Because it's the same Hebrew word, and angel and messenger, the exact same Hebrew word. And it would not be like it was outside the realm of possibility for him to think this way, because the fact that he knew all about the way the angels interacted with Abraham, right? They went before him to deal with Lot, and they know that Lot interacted with the angels, and that the angels kind of went with Lot's bidding. So he had this kind of thing in the back of his head. This is the nature of the relationship of man with angels. So it's at least possible. You know, we don't know, but, you know, it's at least possible. In any case, he sent messengers to Edom, which had been established since Jacob had left 20 years prior, because Edom was the land of Esau. So in 20 years, Esau had begun to establish a dynasty in Seir. So named Edom is named after him or the Edomites. Verses 4 through 5, Jacob thought to ease Esau's potential anger, which might still be brewing within his heart, due to his deception previously by taking his birthright and so on. He sought to ease his potential anger by speaking to him in submissive terms and wealth, right? He presented himself as your servant. He called him my Lord, which is the same word Adonai. It means master. He was calling his brother, who, according to his actions and according to the pronouncement and prophecy of his father, he was Esau's master, right? But Jacob is supplying supplications to Esau, calling him master and calling himself Esau's servant. So he's kind of like throwing a role review reversal out there in hopes that the softness of my words and my many gifts will maybe turn your anger in case you're still wanting to kill me, right?
But Esau was the older.
He was the older, yes. But by prophecy and by birthright, because of what had transpired, he was the one that was the leader. Right, and the pronouncement that God gave through Isaac to Esau was that he was going to be his brother's servant. So, and Jacob knew this, and Esau knew this, but Jacob was being very deliberate in his usage of terms. I'm assuming the role that I should have assumed a long time ago. I'm your servant. You're my lord, and here's some gifts. Right, because he was terrified. He was scared of him. And this was before he even got the word back, right? When he got the word back, he was all the more scared. But he starts off with this because he's trying to buy safety and peace by some exchange of wealth and cozy words. Jacob is fearful, in verse 6 it says so, Jacob is fearful of the coming troop with Esau. In verse 7 through 8, Jacob devises a plan where if there is trouble, all but the first group might escape to safety. So he's kind of rationing things out. This first group I'm going to send out there. And that would automatically tell you where you fit in Esau and Jacob's mind. You know, if you're part of the first group, you know you're expendable. And you go a good distance in front of us. And if you get wiped out, that gives us time to run. I'm sure that those of the people in group number 1 were real honored to be in group number one.
Probably not the best.
Yeah, probably not the best of the servants. Verses 9 through 12, Jacob cries out to God, reminding him of his promise to provide and protect. Verses 13 through 21, and again, I like that it was brought up that there was some humility in his voice. Now, whether that humility was sponsored by his fear or whether it was sponsored by his life lessons or both, and I'll give him credit, it's probably both. I do think it was probably both. There was still genuine humility there, right? I don't deserve all the things you've done for me. Jacob cries out to God, reminding him of his promise to provide and protect. In verse 13 through 21, Jacob sends two caravans of people bearing gifts to buy peace and favor from his brother. In verse 22 through 23, at last he sends over his wives and children and the last of his servants while he remains safely on the other side of the brook. And he stayed back for a night. So, I mean, technically, they're closer to danger than he is. Because, remember, Esau is on the way. And he knew that Esau and his company are going to have to cross this river to get to me. And 400 people don't cross a river, but you hear it. You know what I mean? It's not going to... So I think he felt relatively safe that if I hear it coming, if I hear screams on the other side, I know it's a good idea to probably leave, right? I understand that he definitely held back the children and the wives to last, because he certainly wanted to protect his 11 sons and his wives and all of them, all four of his wives. But still, it seems particularly clear to me that they were still more expendable than his own neck. I think that's pretty clear. Otherwise, he would have kept them behind him. He would have crossed over in front of them because, you know, he was sending them closer to Esau while he stayed further away. That says volumes to me. In verse 24 through 30, some question is left as to whether this was an honest fight or not when we're dealing with Jacob's fight with either the angel or God himself or whatever. And we are left with some amount of question as to what it was. We know Jacob thought it was God, but nothing there classifies that it absolutely was God. Okay, and the reason why we say that, I know that there's a in the passage it says, because you have wrestled with God and man and prevailed. But just because it said you wrestled with God doesn't mean that it didn't mean that you wrestled with a representative of God. That's used all the way through Scripture, right? I mean, you'll hear kings say, I'm going to go do this. But what they mean is I'm going to send somebody to go do this in my name. So it could have been an angel. It could have been God himself. And really, it doesn't matter one way or the other, because we know that God has actually physically come down and interacted with man, even with Abraham, right? We know for sure it was God and two angels who sat down and ate with Abram, right? Or sat in front of Abram while he stood. So we know God definitely interacts with man on that level back then. So could it have been God? Sure. May it have been an angel? Sure. Who knows? Who really cares in the end, right? So, but there seems to be some question whether or not this was an honest fight or not, because some translations said could not prevail. Others said did not prevail. And I think, of course, without any question, the latter is true, because I think that if it's God, there's no question God could have prevailed. And I don't think there's any question that an angel could have either. Angels are, the Bible says, greater in power and might than we are. So I think that whether it was God or an angel, they could have beat the snot out of them if they'd wanted to.
Right.
So prevail means something different. Are you following?
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to look at that just for a second. The latter possibility implying that sufficient effort was supplied against Jacob, that if he had been less tenacious of a person, he would have surrendered, but he didn't. And I think that's what the passage is really saying. It's saying, you have striven, you've strove with God, and not prevailed, but endured. And that's one of the meanings of the word prevailed. You endured. You didn't give up. And God saw that as a good thing, right? In other words, you weren't willing to stop. You held on. Even when I yanked your leg out of your socket, you weren't letting go. And God considered this a noteworthy good thing, right? You have to be careful and look it up for yourself. You'll find that I'm being accurate about that, but I still encourage you to do it. one of the meanings of the word prevail can mean to endure. And I think that that's probably proper here. I don't think that there's any question that Jacob really didn't prevail against God.
Right.
If we're talking about an honest fight, he didn't win it. If it were an angel, he still didn't win it. But he didn't give up. That we know. So prevails, I think, a safe word for it. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
So, let's see. It seems likely that this event was crafted by God to draw out of Jacob a fighting spirit and a request spoken in faith, which it appears was successful. God knew that Jacob was scared to death of his brother. And God wanted Jacob to believe, I'm going to take care of you, not just provide for you. Don't be like your ancestors will be and think, I went through all the trouble to bring you out of Egypt only to kill you in the wilderness, right? You see that wasn't the first time a Jew thought this, right? Because Jacob's got that as a real possibility in the back of his mind. Sure, you prospered me, but are you going to keep me from dying, right? And that was the same question his ancestors had, you know? And to be fair, we've thought the same thoughts before, you know? Well, I know you saved me from hell, but will you pay my bills, right? Well, I know you'll pay my bills, but will you heal my body?
Yes.
You know what I mean? We always have a but will you, right?
Yes.
And God's like, you know what? If he who didn't spare his own son, but freely gave us for us all, how shall he not with him freely give us all things? That's God's perspective on it. Our perspective is, well, I know you did this, but, you know, would you do the other two? You know, we always kind of come with him. And you see that. But this is the good thing that you can see as well in this lineage. You got Abram. Did it. I don't know. I don't remember if Isaac did it or not. He probably did. But we see it here now with Jacob. Each one of them always kind of tested the waters to see how far can I go with this God. Right? Abram did it with his discussion with God about Lot. Right? You know? Okay, would the God of all heaven do what is wrong and destroy the righteous with the wicked? Perhaps there is 50. You know, and you remember that conversation. He kept on whittling God down. And each time it was greater apologies. You know, don't be angry. I know I'm just dust. But should there be 10? I won't say anything else. This is the last time I'm asking. But would you do it for the sake of 10? You know, and you see how, but you know, there's, but still, the point is, he was still in the conversation and he was still willing to ask. That God sees this as positive, right? And we know that, and we also know about God, that if this had been presumptuous, number one, the language would have been different. He would have said, well, even if there's 5, you would be unrighteous if you destroyed them. That would be presumptuous.
Yeah.
We can see that Abraham, when he was talking with God, he was walking on eggshells because he wasn't sure how strong this board he was stepping out on was, right? Mm-hmm. But at least he was willing to have the conversation. And I think that what God was doing with Jacob was trying to draw this out of him, right? And he knew Jacob was a fighter. He will fight. But, you know, what he wanted him to do was to get in this, and because he knew, God knows the future. If I strike him up and engage him in an area where he's already confident and wrestle with him, And he sees that I didn't win the fight, that, you know, the tight fight's still going on. I even dislocate the guy's hip and he still won't let go. It's going to draw out of him a request to bless me. Mm-hmm. Now, you and I have to, again, put ourselves in the same situation as Jacob. What is the only real concern in this guy's mind right now?
Stay alive.
Don't let Esau kill me. So what is he really asking for when he says, bless me? Is he saying, well, give me more money? He's not thinking about that because, number one, he's got enough money. Number two, what good would it do if he dies? He's thinking, bless me as in be my protector because tomorrow I meet Esau. So God wrestled with this man to draw out of him a request. You see what I'm saying?
Ask me.
Just ask me. That's right. You have not because you haven't asked. Right? Now, he did kind of ask before, but he didn't ask with faith. It was more of a, gosh, I hope. Here, he's got him engaged. He's got his grit up. And he says, I'm not letting go until you bless me. So, and even commentators that have a tendency to be a little bit on the fickle side recognize that what this was a prayer of faith. He was not going to let go of this person he believed was God. I'm not letting go of you, God, until you bless me. Yeah, go ahead.
Was this, up until then, it was always God saying what he was going
That's
to
right.
do for him.
So right.
this was, he was trying to...
engage Jacob in faith. Jacob had already kind of engaged because he had said, like Virginia brought up earlier, I don't deserve all that you've done. And, you know, I'm asking you to be with me where I go, like you said you would, right? But you can even see it in the language. And I know we can't hear his voice. We're not back then. But just reading the progression of the thoughts and what we do have unveiled to us about the attitude of his heart, the feelings in his heart, the trepidations in his heart, it wasn't a prayer of faith. It was just a prayer. It's just like, you know, I know you've done these things and I didn't deserve it, but please stick with me through this. Right?
Are you listening?
Yeah. But when God engaged him on this side of the river and nobody's with him to help, he sent all his help ahead of him to protect him from Esau. And God attacks him when he's alone. Right? And there's no one there to help Jacob. It's just you and me, mano a mano. And he wrestled with God. And we see Nancy brought up, clearly he thought it was God because he said so. Right? So, it would have been pointless for him to ask for a blessing from man. He was asking for a blessing for who he believed throughout this wrestling to be God. So God was engaging this man and drawing faith out of him. I personally believe that's what this entire engagement was about. And, you know, sometimes, you know, God does that. You know, sometimes he has to engage you in a wrestling match to snap us into the present. To cause us to realize where we are and who we're dealing with. You know what I mean? And I have no doubt that I think that it's clear that God was pleased with the response he got from Jacob. Because it wasn't presumptuous. God is not pleased with presumption. Right? That's a sin. Jesus made that very clear. Right? There was nothing presumptuous about this. There was just some grit and tenacity and genuine, I'm not letting go if you don't bless me. What we are called to do in faith, right? In prayer. When we approach God, we go to him trusting and unwilling to let go, right?
I think that's... exactly where we need to be.
I agree.
When we have our encounter, we have got to be alone.
Mm-hmm.
With God.
No one can help me, mm-hmm. but God.
And I mean, it's harder. This just hit me. It's harder. You know, you say your quiet time or your alone time or whatever time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Our quiet time and our alone time really isn't our quiet and alone time.
Mm-hmm.
You've got so many distractions around you.
Mm-hmm.
You've got TV, telephone, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But to try to, I think that's this may be one of my near future goals,
mm-hmm.
is to try to find that place.
Mm-hmm.
That alone time place where you're not listening to the radio and I don't even need a book. I don't even need the word in front of me. It's mm-hmm. just that.
It's just God and you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can have that time even, you can, I from experience, I know you can do that in the presence of people, but it's also good to be alone. There's no question. I mean, when I had my encounter where I really met with God, I was surrounded by a bunch of people. Surrounded. But, so the encounter is a location of the heart, not a location in the flesh.
It's a physical location.
But, and I'm telling you, when you get to that place, it doesn't matter whether you're a crowd or not, you will be alone. There wasn't a word anybody in that group could have said to me that could have helped me. I was alone. I was are surrounded and absolutely alone. I was at my wrestling match. And that's a good thing. And I agree with you absolutely. I mean absolutely. Because we've got to come to that place. And God wants to draw us there to a place where he can engage us and draw that grit, that tenacity out of us that says, you know what? I'm not letting go of you. I'm not letting go. You know? Now, I mean, as born-again children of God, he is the blessing. You know what I mean? I'm not letting go until I have more of you. I'm not letting go. Not. And and in that encounter, I'm telling you, you're not having to get God engaged. God engaged you. You know what I mean? And you wouldn't be in this wrestling match if he hadn't picked it. He picked the fight. You know? And that's a good thing. Part of it does initialize as born-again children of God. We're dealing with something different with Jacob because he wasn't a born-again child of God, right? As children of God, we draw near and God draws near to us. So there still has to be something in us that is drawing towards him.
There's so much we can learn from
this. There is so much we can learn from this encounter. There's so much we can learn from this encounter. But I believe with all my heart that's what God was doing. He's answering his prayer, but not the way Jacob thought. He just wanted to be able to breathe a prayer and hope it worked out. And God's like, no, 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 no. See my face. Right? I'm here. I'm not in a prayer. I'm right here. And that was the words that we see out of Jacob's statement here. It says, let's keep on reading it. But hold on. Had you finished your thought or no?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
If something else comes to you, stop me, okay? And feel free to speak it, please. For you have striven with God and man and prevailed. The King James Version says it in a better way. It says, for as a prince, you have power with God and with men and have endured. So, and I'm not sure where the idea of prince came from. I looked it up and I wasn't finding the connective tissue that King James had with it. But one way or the other, we know for a fact that striving was part of this because it's definitely what Israel means. One who strives with God. Right? While it is possible that the man God was speaking about when he said, you have striven with God and men and have prevailed, it could be, while it is possible he was talking about Laban, more likely he was making reference to his coming encounter with his brother Esau. God speaking of things done as though they were done, even though they weren't. In other words, you have striven with me and prevailed, and you will strive with your brother and prevail. Right? I really don't think this was a reference back to Laban. I could be wrong, and I admit that. I'm just saying what I get out of it as I'm reading it. In English, things are a little bit more specific when it comes to do with tenses. And sometimes it is in the Hebrew as well. There's other times when something is spoken in a tense, but it's really kind of ambiguous as to whether it's the past or the future. So, and I think this is probably one of those cases. Jacob asks for his name, though without doubt, he knew it must be God or one of his angels, to which the man, quote-unquote, or God or angel, asks, why do you ask my name? Now, there are several possible reasons for this verbal exchange, but I'm inclined to think that it may have been God's way of offering a little bit of a pushback, since Jacob had thought this to be God, but up to this point had failed to fully embrace God as his own. He had not come to know him by any special name as had his father before him or his grandfather. Again, a type of invitation to a conversation. Up to this point, he knew Abraham had known God by a special name, and so had Isaac. He didn't. He just knew him as the God of my father, the God of Abraham. And he's like, you know, now that we're in a fight, now you're asking me a name? Why are you asking? You're already convinced it's me. Why are you asking? I think it was a little bit, just a little tiny bit of a nudge back, a little bit of a push back, not to be mean in any way, shape, or form, but to just kind of put Jacob gently back on his rear end again, you know, and cause him to realize that, you know what, you could have engaged me and received a name from God that was specific to you in your life anytime the last 20 years. And now that you're in trouble, you want to demand of me a name. What I'm going to do is I'm going to change yours, but I'm not going to give you mine. Right? Now, later on, we see that there's further exchange with God and Jacob, which is another reason why I think this was kind of a pushback from God to get him further into the conversation. God never shut. God, when I say pushback, I'm not talking about a violent kind of thing. I just mean kind of a putting up a little bit of a wall there and saying, you know what? Why are you asking me my name? As if to say, why all of a sudden are you interested? You haven't been interested for 20 years. Why all of a sudden now? Right? I tell you what, I'm going to change yours. But I'm not giving you mine. And I what I see in that is an invitation to a conversation. One that he should have been having all along. You know? One that we all should be having all along. So, so Jacob called the place Peniel, which is facing God. Which is what he got out. That's what Jacob got out of it. Like we said on Sunday, there's what God says, and there's what we hear, right? Well, Jacob, I think, got out of it what God wanted him to get out of it. Up to this point, he had been the God of, and he brought up ancestors, and he recognized, and I know you've done these things for me, right? And that's all well and good, and I want you to be with me where I go. But it wasn't until he engaged with God in this combat that he was laying hold on God. And said, I'm not going to let go until you bless me. And in that exchange, he realized this is about being face to face with God. And that's what he called the place, facing God. That's, I don't know about you, but that almost sends chills down my spine, mm-hmm. You know? I'm going to call this place the place I faced God. Yeah, I imagine that he walked away, even though we had a little bit of a limp now, I think he walked away with a little bit more of a spring in his step, a little bit more confidence approaching Esau than he had before this encounter. Yes.
You said something before that God is the blessing.
Yes.
And the fact that I have seen God face to face, he realized it's his blessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think on some
not
level he did.
Something God to say to him that I'll protect you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think at this point he was getting the real awareness that God literally is with me. I think at this point was the beginning of the turning point. I think it had been progressive work, as everybody I think here has acknowledged. But this was the point, the turning point in his life where he was beginning to claim God as his own. Mm-hmm. You are now my God. Right? So, yes, Doris.
I think at that point where maybe within him a faith developed where it helped him to focus on the future, not only the future encounter with Esau, mm-hmm. but the future based on what had been prophesied over mm-hmm. him so that he could fulfill the destiny
yes.
that was ahead of him.
Amen.
And so therefore that focus changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. I think it reoriented him. Because, you know, the two things that were still remaining of the promise was that he would bring him in peace back to his homeland, to the land of his father, and that God was going to make of him a great nation. He probably wasn't too eager at this point to finish the end of the journey because he already had 11 sons. And he figured, you know, well, the nation started, and I don't want God leaving, and he says he's going to stick with me until I get back there. So, but nonetheless, he did make it eventually. So any other thoughts about chapter 32 before we go to 33? Significant chapter, would you agree?
Yeah.
Yes, yes, Pam.
This is just kind of trivial, but the verse 32, where it talks about, excuse me.
That's okay.
Therefore, the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which mm-hmm. is upon the hollow of the thigh, unto this day.
Mm-hmm. The day that this was written. The children of Israel, up to this day, meaning the when Moses was penning this in the wilderness, the children of Israel would not eat that because out of honor of what happened here.
Okay, so the day that it happened until at least he was writing it.
Until Moses was writing this. Because, I mean, that doesn't mean they didn't continue it past that time, but Moses would have had no way of knowing that. He was just saying, until this day, the day that I'm writing this
okay.
in the wilderness, until this day. Because Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy were written, as far as all Scripture gives us any reason to believe, was written, penned by Moses when he was out in the wilderness meeting God face to face. So, it's not like these chapters were written and handed down over through the ages. This was given to Moses as he was meeting God face to face. So he could only speak to what was occurring unto his day. So evidently, even when they were in captivity, they did not eat that. So yeah.
But what is the purpose?
It was just a way of honoring it. It's just like a memorial stone. It's a big deal back then. And really, I think it's a big deal to humans anyway. I think we have a tendency to have significant events commemorated in one way or another, you know? And what commemorates it to us might seem silly to someone in the Middle East. And what they do might seem silly to us. But we commemorate things, a way of remembering. So I think that's really all it probably was. So, yes?
I've got a question. Mm-hmm. It says, therefore, the children of Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, is that referring to who was at one point Jacob, but is now Israel?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the ongoing, who become the children of Israel. I mean, it's a, every time I hear that, I always think of this song from Steve Taylor. It's a, it's called Cash Cow, and it's talking about the cow that they built when they came out in the middle of the wilderness. Really quite cute. But he talks about the fact that he said, they looked over the desert and said it glittered and glowed with the gold of the children of Israel and most of the adults. But anyway, I know, it's just kind of a funny thing. But yeah, all of Israel, the children of Israel just means the offspring of Jacob. So it would mean for Moses writing this, he would be talking about all the children that came eventually out of Jacob. So the children of Israel. Yes. Uh-huh.
I was reading ahead because I didn't know how far we were going to go.
Yeah.
And I had a question as far as there were two times. I guess it was in 32. Okay, which is, and then in 35,
mm-hmm.
God also says your name is changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like he's
reminding
for
him
the first time, or
no? He's reminding him. He's reminding him because Jacob went on to continue to call himself and have other people call him Jacob, more so than Israel. So I don't. There's a way in which Jacob didn't fully embrace it. He did, but he didn't. It was again progressive work in him. So and I, the only person I know of that I can think of that seemed to, well, no, we don't even know that for sure. It seems likely though that Abraham probably embraced Abraham right away. But there's no real proof of that.
No, it's not that big of a change.
No, it's not. No, it's not. But Noah, but of course, them knowing what those words meant, it would have been a huge, you know, significant to them. Even though you're right, as far as letters, it's not much of a name change.
It would be sort of like if you have your name given to you at birth.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be called that, and you also be called nicknames as you grow up. So, but then as you get older, you're being called by your given name, your birth name. Mm-hmm. But then when you begin to realize, when you understand the meaning of that name, mm-hmm. it can change your viewpoint of not only so-and-so, but I am mm-hmm. so-and-so, and it means this.
Mm-hmm.
And it has an effect on you in a way that would be a little more significant than just a name.
Yeah, yeah. I think that probably the name Israel was kind of a big one to find a place to live in, you know. I mean, he knew that it was a fact, but I think that probably for the rest of his life, he probably wrestled with that encounter of wrestling, you know. I'm the one that strove with God. I'm not even sure what to do with that name. I'm the one that wrestled with God. What bag do I put that in? You know, I think he probably... He had to wrestle with the name Russell for a while. It had to grow on him, you know. I know it would me. You know, if God would speak to me and change my name, I imagine that all of us would probably be spending a lot of time thinking about that meaning of that name, right, you know. So it probably was just, again, like we said, it's a progressive work. And I'm sure God was not upset with him for not wearing it proudly the next day, necessarily. Yes, uh-huh.
I just did it as an invitation
mm-hmm. yeah.
to something he wanted to come from him.
Yeah,
he did not know yet that it was going to come from him.
Yeah.
He knew there was something God was expecting, but...
God had initiated it there,
right.
But and he wanted it to continue. I would agree with you, absolutely. Yes, I agree with you. So rather than reading chapter 33, I'm assuming you guys have read it. I'm going to go ahead and let us just go make comments on it because of time, for time's sake, so we can get through chapter 33, that we're not in a rush. If we get halfway through it and still there's lots of meat on that bone, We'll continue next week. But for time's sake, I'm going to make the assumption you guys read chapter 33. And so what are some of the comments that you may have about that chapter?
Well, he definitely crosses over before his family. It says that then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground. So he's...
When he finally met up with them. Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because they've come. Yeah, I was concerned about them.
Yeah. With good reason. Because he doesn't... He does seem, in all honesty, Jacob does come across as a bit of a coward with all this.
Yeah.
He really does. You would think that the average guy would have gone out in front of them all because he's the progenitor of the family, and you know everything behind you is supposed to be protected by you, you know. But instead, he kind of sent everybody else ahead of him. So,
I can only imagine the mixture of emotions that he had when Esau came and ran to him and embraced him. It's like, you know, I don't know how to handle this first.
Yeah.
I mean, but he, you know, they embraced and he said and he kissed him and they wept.
Yeah.
So the relief that was there and probably the joy of the Lord within him, thinking, this is my brother that I feared.
Mm-hmm.
And now
he's been restored to me.
We are now reunited in a much more powerful, loving way.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. I hope that it really was all that. I just never know.
We really don't know.
But I agree with you. I mean, on first blush, when you read it, it seems like all of that's very genuine.
Right.
And I hope that it was. There doesn't seem in my mind to be a whole lot of question that Jacob was still afraid.
Yeah.
After the initial embrace, he probably allowed himself to feel hope at the restoration with his brother. But I think after the hug was over, and a little bit of time settled in, I think he began to wonder, I did trick him.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if he might not be trying to trick me and trying to get me to lower my guard here. We don't know that. We don't know that. I certainly don't want to spoil it with that possibility, but it is at least possible. But the hug seems genuine. And I'm sure that at least in the moment was a huge, as you said, relief. A huge relief, you know. Not only he's relieved from fear, but he's also probably feels, at least for a moment, a restoration of a relationship that had meant something to him at some point, you know. So
they were twin brothers, for instance.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be some sort of connection there.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, I agree. And it's at this point in the book that I am still reading, called Son of Laughter by Frederick Buechner, that it has some interesting things to say about their relationship. But earlier, when the kind of relationship they had back when the deception took place, there's a lot in there that is just kind of interesting. Some of it, of course, is speculative, but it's still interesting. But
it doesn't really address why Esau came with so many people.
No, it doesn't.
Unless it was that he was told, when he was told that Jacob was coming and there was a lot of people with him,
mm-hmm.
that it might have been, self-defense just in case.
Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, I really don't know. Because we know so little about the heart and the intentions of Esau.
Yeah.
And we do know that that overall, he was not a good man. God doesn't say, Esau, I have hated, to people who were generally good. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So, I really just don't know. We have a lot of question as to what was in the heart of Esau in the first place. But, yes?
Well, I think it tells later on when the children of Israel comes out of Egypt, they have a problem with Edom.
Well, I know. Yes, they do.
So,
but the question that I have about that is whether or not it was a conflict that was birthed out of the conflict of the brothers initially, or a secondary conflict that we see here in this chapter. So I'm not sure. What are some other thoughts you guys have?
Well, to me it's like all they had, they really didn't write things down, and they had word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
They
they handed things down from generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
If Esau, you know, during this time had children and spouted, my brother did this and my brother did that, mm-hmm. they would have carried that down and down. But anyway, also, when the brothers fell on one another, it reminded me of Jesus' parable of the prodigal son.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was so, you know, what the Jews would have thought, stay away from me, kid. Mm-hmm. You know, you smell like pigs.
Yeah.
Well, there was an embrace of running.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. An embrace.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, Esau encouraged him to keep his what he had sent. And it wasn't like, I don't think he's saying it like, you know, you can't buy my love.
Mm-hmm. The words don't lead me to believe that either. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of this that does seem genuine on Esau's part. So that, you know, that's a good thing.
Can you explain the significance of Jacob bowing himself to the ground 7 times?
I'm not sure what the 7 times was for, because I don't know what the culture was thought about that back then. No, I didn't
know if it had a specific meaning.
I'm sure it probably did. But just because of the fact that later on in Jewish belief, 7 meant the perfect number doesn't mean that it meant that back then. So, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But without question, falling prostrate before his brother was definitely a sign of placing himself underneath his brother.
Well, having his wives and children do the same.
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. But, you have to like Esau's reply of, what are you doing? Why are you doing this, right? And what's all the stuff you're giving me, right? And you know, when Jacob owns it, he says, well, you know, I thought maybe it might, you know, make you a little bit happier to see me. You know? And then, you know, keep it. I don't want your stuff. So, it seems altogether like a very good exchange. It's kind of interesting. Not at all what one would have expected. So, and it was also possible that Esau had come into his own and had just come to be at terms and at peace with things. Because one of the last statements of his father Isaac over him in his pronouncement was, and when you have grown weary of his yoke, you'll shake it off of you. So, Esau had his own wrestling match to do. He had to wrestle with the fact that his brother was the senior brother, even though he was younger, technically, and that he received the blessing and he received all of this stuff. He had to deal with that. And that was baggage he had to wear for 20 years, too. And I think that Isaac, part of his prophecy over his son, it may have either been a foreseeing into the future what was going to happen, or a prophetic word that would help guide it in happening, that eventually Jacob would let go of the bitterness and shake the shackle of his brother off of him. Not that his brother really had a shackle on him, but you know, if you view it as a shackle, it is one. You know what I mean? And so it's very likely that that had happened before this encounter. Or I don't think this encounter would have turned out as well as it did. So that's my view of it anyway. So.
Well, at that point, I think too, Saul's heart, he wasn't viewed as an enemy, because why would he have accepted it finally?
Mm-hmm.
Because he did take it after being urged by Jacob. He did take the, mm-hmm. He wouldn't have taken it from somebody you at odds with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because the one thing you don't want is to be beholden to that person.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yes. So, I agree with you. So, so in verses 1 through 3, Jacob seems a bit of a coward here, and he shows his picking order from most expendable to least. Verses 4 through 16 is a beautiful reunion and departure. The rest of the chapter, it's not stated whether or not he actually kept his word and met his brother in Seir or not. It doesn't seem likely. And one of the reasons is because of the fact that he was on his way to Succoth, which is in the north, and Seir was in the far south. So, and it doesn't say that he went, turned on, made a 180 and head back to where his brother was and then progressed to Succoth. It just said that he went on to Succoth, which would have been the opposite direction of his brother. So this gives me reason to think anyway, or to speculate, and that's all it can possibly be because we don't know, that he was like, you know what? Whew, that went well. Let's not tempt fate. I got a hug. We did good. I gave him some stuff. I feel better. I don't know about you guys, but I feel better about this, right? You know, talking to his family and friends, and hey, and I sent him away not empty-handed. I think I kind of evened the score of what I did when I was a kid and impetuous. So, you know, let's just leave this all right there, and I'll go on to Succoth and let him just think I'm going to come, and I'm not really going to go. It gives us the impression that that's what happened here. There's nothing to give us any indication that he made a 180 and traveled all the way down there and spent time with his brother, had a big time, and then went up here. I don't think that took place. It might have, but it strikes me as odd that if he had, it wouldn't have been brought up in some way. Here, if you just read the words, it sounds like he left his brother, said he's going to join him, and didn't. That's what it sounds like. Are you following me?
I leave well enough alone.
Yeah, but but if in fact he did it this way, it would have been another deception, and it might have been the very thing that turned things bitter in Esau's mouth. That may have been made influenced the future Edomites to not really feel like helping out the Israelites when they needed it 400 years later, right? You know, because like you brought up, Virginia, they hold on to these things and they pass them on. And, you know, and what is this? You know, our forefather Esau came and met you in good faith. He could have killed you and he didn't. You know, you showed a sign of good faith. You guys wept together and embraced one another. And you said you'd join us and then you took off. You know, and like you never met us and you didn't have any affiliation with us ever again. And here you show up at our doorstep 400 years later and want a favor. I'm not inclined to give you that favor. I think that's probably how it played out. I don't know, but I think it probably is. So there's no question that the Edomites and the Israelites were not real chummy. They weren't friends of one another. And it may very well be that it was due to Jacob here not keeping his word. But again, I can't stress enough that that is just speculation, because it is possible that Jacob did in fact go back and spend time with his brother and then go up to Succoth. But there's just no proof of that. And there's nothing in the language that would lead you to believe that's actually what happened. So that's something I think that is interesting.
Where was Succoth in relation to Bethel? Because he was supposed to be going to Bethel, right?
He was supposed to go to Bethel. I was about to bring that up. That's a good point. God had told him to do that, and he didn't actually bother for quite some time. He settled in, and I'm not exactly sure where it is. I know it is relative to where he said he was going to go and see her, but, I mean, it may have been that was before or after Paddan Aram, because he clearly went to go back to Paddan Aram, but in this chapter, it doesn't tell you anything about that encounter in Paddan Aram. It just says that after he left Succoth and went on to Shechem, he went to Shechem, having been through already Paddan Aram. So whether he went to Paddan Aram before he went to Succoth or after, he definitely did it before he came to Shechem. But none of this included him going to Bethel, which is like Doris brought up. That was definitely what God had told him to do. I really don't know. I'm not sure. I imagine
he's still making his own choices.
Yes, he definitely is. There's no question. He's definitely making his own choices still. So so he went there. He built a house in Succoth. How long he stayed there, we don't know. He eventually went on to Shechem and bought a piece of land there. Guzik notes that it was there that he erected an altar. Of course, it was called El Elohi Israel, which is not so much a statement about being the God of Israel as is he was calling the altar of the God who is the God of Israel. So in the Hebrew, it was essentially saying, this is the altar of God who is the God of Israel. Okay? So this is the real first time that we have, at least from his own mouth, claiming God to be his own God and him claiming the name Israel for his own. So when he finally got to Shechem, he built the altar and he said, this is the altar of the God who is the God of Israel. Meaning my God, the God of Israel. Though he did may have built an altar there, it was obedience that really God wanted from him. And he wasn't obedient to go to Bethel yet. So we want to also pay attention to that because, you know, Jacob's still learning. It's still a progressive work in him. You know, he's real glad that God didn't let him die with his brother. And that was a good thing. But he's not exactly in a hurry to get back where God told him to go. He built an altar to God, and that's great, but it wasn't where God told him to build an altar. God told him to go back to Bethel, right? And he didn't go. At least not yet, right? We'll see as we keep on going what happens. But up to this point, his obedience was far from immediate, right? So he was dragging his feet. And that also tells us something about the man. It looks very familiar to what I often see in the mirror. You know, have a tendency to drag our feet when it comes to you. We're all glad when God comes through for us, right? Throw a party, that was great. I remember what you said. I'm on my way. I'll get there after I build a house and do this and hang out in another place for a while. I'll get there. So, and assume that when we build an altar where we want to build an altar, that God's supposed to accept that is okay. You know, and God's like, you know, you can build altars all day long. What I want you to do is get to freaking Bethel and build an altar for me there, because that's what I asked for. So, but you know, we get around to it, and God's gracious, isn't He gracious? If He was a parent like I would be, this would not have gone over well. So I'm very glad that God is very, very merciful and kind.
Yeah.
So, any other thoughts?
One thought that I had was when Jacob asked the angel's name, or whatever it was, I had heard a long time ago that one of the customs...
I'd said it here. That the custom of the day was that if someone won a fight, you won their name.
Yes.
And that's possibly true. I don't think that was what was happening here.
Right.
Reflection, I first used to think that, and I'm not saying that maybe there might not be something to that now, in a slightly twisted form, because I think that Jacob was looking for what his fathers had had. A specific name from God that he could call him by, like his fathers had had. And God wasn't going to give it to him, at least not at this point. But as far as him, I don't think that Jacob was under any pretense that he actually thought he won the fight. So I don't think that, even though I've said that before, I don't think it's probably accurate.
Right. But also, too, I had heard, too, that when you ask somebody their name, it's who they are.
Mm-hmm. What?
It's who they are.
Well, yeah. Well, that was the case with all names back then.
Oh, mm-hmm. All the names back then is who mm-hmm. they are.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, what that person was getting to was who are you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and mm-hmm. associating with, who can I say, mm-hmm. you know, in my own mind, who am I dealing with here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting.
Yes. The entire encounter is very interesting.
Yeah.
But I think that the great takeaway is, I think, without question, God was trying to engage this man to get him into genuine trust. And I think he was successful.
Yeah.
So, and you know, and again, it shows us that that God can come to you in ways that you're not expecting. I think that probably if Jacob had considered a million ways God could come to him, and have an encounter with him, the last one, if it ever would have sprung into his mind at all, it would have been on the last of the list of having a wrestling match with him.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Yeah. But, you know, God sometimes is the God of the unexpected. He will come to you in ways that you... I think one of the reasons why, and again, another literary thing comes to my mind, a book that I read, this guy that was a private investigator who was investigating a crime, he was dealing with a person that he thought might have been privy to the incident of a murder, and he deliberately guided his conversation with the man to bring things up that he knew he could tell by the man's demeanor and his way and his thought patterns he would not have expected, to keep him off balance. And I think that's kind of what God was doing here. He was trying to keep Jacob off balance. Because if God just shown up the way Jacob expected, it wouldn't there would have been no life-changing encounter.
Right.
But, you know, and again, I'm sure, I know that there's some people that aren't comfortable with it, but again, to me, this was another selling point for the book, The Shack. God showing up as a big black woman threw the guy off of his... He wasn't expecting this. And God has a way of doing this. He just shows up in a way that you don't expect. And it throws you off balance long enough for him to get a word in edgewise.
Yeah.
So you begin to see an aspect of God that you would have never considered before. Right? He's got a way of doing that. And, you know, sometimes if we don't have eyes to see, if we have got it gridlocked in our head, God can only come to me this way. Even if he did show up in a wrestling match or as a big black woman, you wouldn't have eyes to see it, you know? And sometimes it requires something that radical to get our attention, you know? And when he does, you know, things can, the relationship can continue, because I think that was another thing that Terry drew out that she's continued to bring this up as we've gone through Genesis, that it seems like God has a tendency to lapse into silence with his followers, with these men, until they start moving again. You know, as soon as he started towards Bethel, God shows up with angels. You know, every time when he left his father and his mother and started towards Laban, God shows up. You know, and God, you know, God's got a way of doing that. You know, and you know, and he'll speak to them, and you know, like when God, obviously God revealed himself in some way or another to Moses. There's nothing inside of man that's noble enough to want to do the right thing. It doesn't exist. Certainly not for non-regenerate man. And yet Moses is there in the most cushy position you can be in the early world, growing up in the palaces of Egypt. And looking down upon people who were of the same skin and same appearance as himself, he knew he did not belong in this family. You know, I mean, the Hamites were black people. You know, it didn't take an Einstein to figure out that I'm not a black guy. You know what I mean? He had to know I was adopted. You know, he had to know this. This was not rocket science. And for him to look down at these other people who look a lot like him and to say, you know what? I'd rather, as the scripture told us, I'd rather suffer affliction with the people of God than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. That doesn't just spring out of a non-regenerate heart unless God's been doing some work. Right? And so God encounters him, but he does something dumb and he winds up on the backside of the desert. And God just lets him dwell there for 40 years, and then God encounters him again, right? And another thing begins that you see chapters happen when you have encounters like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an ongoing thing that we'll continue to see. So I think that's a good thing that Terry has faithfully pointed that out every time this happens. So, all right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Just one last thought with that as you were talking. On the more simple day-to-day aspect,
mm-hmm.
It's like God can finally speak to us when we get out of our routine.
Yeah, and our comfort zones.
When we get out of our comfort zones and we take the, you know, a break and look, go someplace different than normal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's true in our everyday life. And we get so caught up in our everyday routines and our everyday things to do. Like Nancy was saying in the beginning, we need to find those places and those times where we get away.
Yes. Absolutely. Deliberately with the intent of meeting with him, having our encounter, as you said, Nancy.